Then he saw the white robes of the priests, flitting like moths in the torchlight as they wound along the trail. The camp servants fell on their knees as the first of the holy men entered the perimeter of the camp. They were young acolytes, bareheaded and barefooted. They were followed by the monks, wearing long robes and tall turbans. Their ranks wheeled aside and opened up. An honour guard for the phalanx of deacons and fully ordained priests in their gaudy embroidered robes and vestments. Each of them carried a heavy Coptic cross, set on a tall staff and intricately chased and worked in native silver. They in turn opened into two ranks, still chanting, and allowed the canopied palanquin to be carried forward by four hefty young acolytes and placed in the centre of the camp. The crimson and yellow silk curtains shimmered in the light of the camp lanterns and the torches of the procession. "We must go forward and welcome the abbot," Boris told Nicholas in a stage whisper. "His name is Jali Horra." As they stepped up to the litter, the curtains were drawn dramatically aside and a tall figure stepped down to earth. Both Tessé and Royan sunk to their knees respectfully and clasped their hands at the breast. However, Nicholas and Boris remained on their feet, and Nicholas inspected the abbot with interest. Jali Horra was skeletally thin. Beneath the skirts of his robe, his legs were like sticks of cured tobacco, tar-black and twisted, with desiccated sinew and stringy muscle. His robe was green and gold, worked with gold thread that glittered in the firelight. On his head, he wore a tall hat with a flat top embroidered with a pattern of crosses and stars. The abbot's face was dead sooty black, the skin wrinkled and riven with the deep etchings of age. There were few teeth behind his puckered lips, and even these were yellowed and askew. His beard was startlingly silver-white, breaking like storm surf on the old bones of his jaw. One eye was opaque, blue, and blinded with tropical ophthalmia, but the other eye glistened like that of a hunting leopard. He began to speak in a high, quavering voice. "A blessing," Boris warned Nicholas, and they both bowed their heads respectfully. The assembled priests came in with the chanted response each time the old man paused. When at last he had finished giving his blessing, Jali Horra made the sign of the cross in four directions, rotating slowly towards each point of the compass, while two altar boys swung their silver censers vigorously, deluging the night with pungent clouds of incense smoke. After the blessing, the two women came forward to kneel before the abbot. He stooped over them and struck them lightly on each cheek with his silver cross, chanting a falsetto blessing over them.
"They say the old man is over 100 years old, Boris whispered to Nicholas.
Two white-robed deteras brought forward a stool of African ebony, so beautifully carved that Nicholas eyed it acquisitively. He guessed that it was probably centuries old, and would have made a handsome addition to the museum collection. The two deteras took Jali Hora's elbows and gently seated him on the stool. Then the rest of the company sank to earth in a congregation around him, their black faces lifted towards him attentively. Tessé sat at his feet, and when her husband spoke, she translated quietly for him into Amharic. "It is a great pleasure and an honour for me to greet you again, Holy Father." The old man nodded, and Boris went on. "I have brought an English nobleman of royal blood to visit the monastery of St. Frumentius."
"I say, steady on, old boy," Nicholas protested, but all the congregation studied him with expectant interest.
"What do I do now?" he asked Boris out of the corner of his mouth.
"What do you think he came all the way for?" Boris grinned maliciously. "He wants a gift. Money."
"Maria Theresa dollars?" he inquired, referring to the centuries-old traditional currency of Ethiopia.
"Not necessarily. Times have changed. Jali Horra will be happy to take Yankee greenbacks."
"How much?"
"You're a nobleman of royal blood. You will be hunting in his valley.
$500 at least." Nicholas winced and went to fetch his bag from one of the mule panniers. When he came back, he bowed to the abbot and placed the sheaf of currency in his outstretched pink-palmed claw. The abbot smiled, exposing the yellow stumps of his teeth, and spoke briefly. Tessé translated for him. "He says, 'Welcome to the monastery of St. Frumentius and the season of Timcat. He wishes you good hunting on the banks of the Abai River.'"
Immediately the solemn mood of the devout company changed. They broke out in smiles and laughter, and the abbot looked expectantly at Boris.
"The holy abbot says it has been a thirsty journey," Tessé translated.
"The old devil loves his brandy," Boris explained, and shouted to the camp butler.
With some ceremony, a bottle of brandy was brought and placed on the camp table in front of the abbot, shoulder to shoulder with the bottle of vodka in front of Boris. They toasted each other, and the abbot tossed back a dram that made his good eye weep with tears and his voice husky as he directed a question at Royan. "He asks you, Wazir Royan, where do you come from, daughter, that you follow the true path of a Christ, the Saviour of man?"
"I am an Egyptian of the old religion," Royan replied. The abbot and all his priests nodded and beamed with approval.
"We are all brothers and sisters in Christ, the Egyptians and the Ethiopians," the abbot told her. "Even the word Coptic derives from the Greek for Egyptian. For over 1600 years, the Abuna, the bishop of Ethiopia, has always appointed by the patriarch in Cairo. Only the emperor Haile Selassie changed that in 1959, but we still follow the true road to Christ. You are welcome, my daughter." His debtor poured another dram of brandy, and the old man swallowed it at a gulp. Even Boris looked impressed.
"Where does the skinny old black tortoise put it?" he wondered aloud.
Tessé did not translate, but she lowered her eyes, and the hurt she felt for the insult to the holy man showed on her Madonna features. Jali Hora turned to Nicholas. "He wants to know what animals you have come to hunt here in this valley," Tessé told him.
Nicholas steeled himself and then replied carefully. There was a long moment of disbelief. Then the abbot cackled happily, and the assembled priests shouted with incredulous mirth.
"A dik-dik. You have come to hunt a dik-dik. But there is no meat on an animal that size." Nicholas let them get over the first shock and then produced a photograph of the mountain specimen of Makodwa Haperi from the museum. He placed it on the table in front of Jali Hora.
"This is no ordinary dik-dik. It is a holy dik-dik," he told them in portentous tones, nodding at Tessé for the translation.
"Let me recount the legend."
They were silenced by the prospect of a good story with religious overtones. Even the abbot arrested the glass on its way to his lips and replaced it on the table. His one eye swiveled from the photograph to Nicholas's face.
"When John the Baptist was dying of starvation in the desert," Nicholas began, and a few of the priests crossed themselves at the mention of the saint's name, "he had been 30 days and 30 nights without a morsel passing his lips." Nicholas spun out the yarn for a while, dwelling on the extremities of hunger endured by the saint, details savoured by his audience, who liked their holy men to suffer in the name of righteousness. "In the end, the Lord took mercy on his servant and placed a small antelope in a thicket of acacia held fast by the thorns. He said unto the saint, 'I have prepared a meal for you that you shall not die. Take of this meat and eat.' Where John the Baptist touched the small creature, the marks of his thumb and fingers were imprinted upon its back for all time and all generations to come." They were silent and impressed. Nicholas passed the photograph to the abbot. "See the prints of the saint's fingers upon it?" The old man studied the print avidly, holding it up to his single eye, and at last he exclaimed,
"It is true. The marks of the saint's fingers are clear to see."
He passed it to his deacons. Encouraged by the abbot's endorsement, they exclaimed and wondered over the picture of the insignificant creature in its coat of striped fur.
"Have any of your men ever laid eyes upon one of these animals?" Nicholas demanded,
and one after the other they shook their heads.
The photograph completed the circle and was passed to the rank of squatting acolytes. Suddenly one of them leapt to his feet, prancing, brandishing the photograph and gibbering with excitement. "I have seen this holy creature with my very own eyes. I have seen it." He was a young boy, barely adolescent. There were cries of derision and disbelief from the others. One of them snatched the print from the boy's grasp and waved it out of his reach, taunting him with it. "The child is soft in the head and often possessed by demons and fits," Jolly Horror explained sorrowfully. "Take no notice of him. Poor Tamre." Tamre's eyes were wild as he ran down the rank of acolytes, trying desperately to recapture the photograph. But they passed it back and forth, keeping it just out of his reach, teasing him and jeering at his antics. Nicholas rose to his feet to intervene. He found this taunting of a weak-minded lad offensive. But at that moment, something tripped in the boy's mind, and he fell to the ground as though struck down by a club. His back arched and his limbs twitched and jerked uncontrollably. His eyes rolled back into his skull until only the whites showed, and white froth creamed on his lips that were drawn back in a grinning rictus. Before Nicholas could go to him, four of his peers picked him up bodily and carried him away. Their laughter dwindled into the night. The others acted as though this was nothing out of the ordinary, and Jolly Horror nodded to his detera to refill his glass. It was late when at last Jolly Horror took his leave and was helped into the palanquin by his deacons. He took the remains of the brandy with him, clutching the half-empty bottle in one clawed hand and tossing out benedictions with the other. "You make a good impression, me lord English," Boris told him. "He liked your story of John the Baptist, but he liked your money even more." When they set out the next morning, the path followed the river for a while. But within a mile the waters quickened their pace and then raced through the narrow opening between high red cliffs and plunged over another waterfall. Nicholas left the well-trodden trail and went down to the brink of the falls. He looked down 200 feet into a deep cleft in the rock, only just wide enough to allow the angry river to squeeze through. He could have thrown a stone across the gap. There was no path nor foothold in that chasm, and he turned back and rejoined the rest of the caravan as it detoured away from the river and into another thickly wooded valley. This was probably once the course of the Dandira River, before it cut a fresh bed for itself through the chasm. Royan pointed to the high ground on each side of the path, and then to the water-worn boulders that littered the trail. "I think you're right," Nicholas agreed. "These cliffs seem to be an intrusion of limestone through the basalt and sandstone. The whole area has been severely faulted and cut up by erosion and the ever-changing river. You can be certain that those limestone cliffs are riddled with caves and springs." Now the trail descended rapidly towards the Blue Nile, falling away almost 1,500 feet in altitude in the last few miles. The sides of the valley were heavily covered with vegetation, and at many places small springs of water oozed from the limestone and trickled down the old river bed. The heat built up steadily as they went down, and soon even Royan's khaki shirt was stained with dark patches of sweat between her shoulder blades. At one stage a freshet of clear water gushed from an area of dense bush high up the hillside and swelled the stream into a small river. Then they turned a corner of the valley and found that they and the stream had rejoined the main flow of the Dandira River. Looking back up the gorge, they could see where the river had emerged from the chasm through a narrow archway in the cliff. The rock surrounding the cleft was a peculiar pink in colour, smooth and polished, folded back upon itself so that it resembled the mucous membrane on the inside of a pair of human lips.